Hello and welcome to Growth Coaching International's Coaching in Education podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reid, and I'm excited to share that this is the first in a mini-series of episodes called Instructional Coaching Done Well. We are recording these episodes to coincide with the upcoming Instructional Coaching Done Well Roadshow, which will run in three locations in Australia in June 2025. At the same time, both the Instructional Coaching Group and Independent Schools Tasmania will be dedicating some of their podcasting time to support the roadshow. Knowing that every school is different, how do you create a sustainable, impactful instructional coaching program that really works in both the short and the long term? We're going to make a start to answering that question in this episode, where I'm joined by none other than Dr. Jim Knight himself, alongside our own Executive Director, Chris Munro. Gentlemen, we are bringing together Nebraska in the US, County Down in Northern Ireland, and Melbourne in Australia. You're both very welcome to a truly global conversation. Jim, you have written extensively on the topic of instructional coaching, and one thing that makes your approach unique is the seven success factors. I think it would be great for our listeners in this opening episode if we could share a taster of each of these. So Jim, starting with you, do you want to jump into the partnership principles to begin with?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Grateful to be here and excited about our global impact we have here with Australia and Ireland and Nebraska. It's a pretty diverse situation. I'm super excited to talk about this, Richard. You know, we've been studying instructional coaching for about 25 years, and I started with the partnership principles, but we've done a whole bunch of different types of studies. If people go to instructionalcoaching.com and look at the research, they can see what 25 years of research looks like. Qualitative, quantitative studies, formal, informal studies. But one of the more formal ones was the study of the partnership approach. And I read really widely in different literature on how to interact with people in successful ways to facilitate change. And then I did a study, and we found that when we took the partnership approach, people were 4.5 times, they reported they were 4.5 times more likely to implement than if they didn't. We didn't take that approach. I think the numbers were something like 58 to 13. And so we feel strongly this is an evidence-based approach, and partnership at the heart of it, what it is I'm positioning myself as an equal with you. It doesn't mean we treat everybody the same. We see the uniqueness of every individual, but I don't see you as someone I have to control. I don't parent you. I'm an equal with you. And when we talk together, there's energy in the conversation. We co-construct knowledge. We're engaged. Each voice counts in the conversation. It's very back and forth. And we've articulated a list of principles. I won't go into all the principles, but there's this real sense in which I'm not here to fix you or to solve you or to tell you what to do. I'm here to interact with you as one professional talking with another. Let's figure it out together. And when other people feel they have autonomy and choice and control over what they do, it's much more likely they'll embrace anything that we co-construct. They're building it with us. And like I said, when we studied it, there was a vastly different response to the partnership approach than when we didn't use the partnership approach. So I'd say, in the essence, partnership is about a professional form of discourse with another professional.
I think a key thing to what you're saying there, Jim, is that research, you know, being able to stand over those years where you've tried out a variety of different things. And you can stand over, you know, the partnership approach essentially being that much more effective. I mean, the data's there in many ways to prove it, which is fantastic. Chris, a big part of the coaching conversation is going to be communication. So communication skills as one of the seven success factors. Anything you want to share with us on that one?
Yeah, and thank you, Richard. And again, yeah, it's just such a joy to be part of this conversation. And Jim knows, and you've heard me say this before, you know, I met the partnership principles, that first success factor back in 2011. That was my first, that was, I sort of, without sounding too evangelical, I saw the light at that point. And for me, they still, it's appropriate that they're the first success factor here because they underpin so much of what we do. A coach here in Australia said to me once, they provide a set of touchstones that we return to time and again to just check in on how we are as coaches, how we are showing up as coaches. If something feels not quite right or has gone off track, it's maybe because we're not living out one of those partnership principles fully enough and we need to revisit them. So fundamental to what we do, that like how I show up. And then the second part that you've alluded to there and invited me to talk about is the communication skills. You know, you can say, and I think John Campbell and Christian Van Nieuwenberg said this in The Leader's Guide at one point, that you'll sometimes hear coaching's just a conversation. Well, it's not just a conversation. Yes, clearly it's a conversation, but it's a very nuanced, carefully managed conversation. And when we say managed, we don't mean directed, we don't mean led in terms of forced. We mean that the coach is being really conscious on how they listen, what they listen for, the kinds of questions they respond with, the kind of other techniques they respond with, and they reflect back what they're hearing from the other person. And then importantly, managing their own voice in that conversation, and that balance between, and in the definitive guide, to talk about, you know, balancing telling with asking. And is this a genuine stance of inquiry for me, or am I really asking leading questions and trying to get them to see things my way? So there's a subtle, you know, management thing in yourself in there, but there's also a shaping the conversation through the way we deploy those skills. And you won't find a coaching manual anywhere in the world that doesn't have questioning and listening in it, but it's even more sophisticated than that. You know, what is it we're listening for? You know, what's the purpose of this? And I always boil it down to those communication skills are one of the key ways that we support the thinking and progress of that other person. Whatever my next move in the conversation is, it might be silence, might be my next move in the conversation, it's in service of their thinking and progress. So if the principles are the kind of way I'm showing up and the way I'm experienced in that conversation, the communication skills are the fuel that drive the conversation.
I like that phrase or that word you use, stance, is really important. And certainly for a lot of coaches in the initial days, you know, when you're training at the start, that idea of getting the stance right is so important. And again, you use that phrase, in service of the other. So being able to adjust your stance accordingly, which is going to be very helpful for our listeners, Chris. Jim, and this is one people mightn't think about just straight away, is coaches as leaders. And I'm sitting here with my principal hat on thinking, okay, now where are we going with coaches as leaders? Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I think really when you think about leadership, everybody has a role as a leader. Everybody is trying to make a difference. And so we talk about leadership as involving two things, leading yourself, leading others. Now, when you lead yourself, it's about identifying your purpose, what matters to you, and what you're trying to accomplish. You know, we've got a small number of hours and days on this planet. What are we going to do with that time? And to constantly think about it, reflect back and analyze, am I living consistently with my purpose, what I'm trying to accomplish? And then once I'm clear on why I'm here, what I'm trying to do, how am I using my time? Leadership is about how you manage your own time, but it's also about dealing with external factors, like is there role clarity around my job and the person I report to? Have we worked through how much I have to do? I can increase a lot of my ability to succeed by decreasing the number of things that take up my time. And then a third big part of that in terms of leading yourself is self-compassion. Treating yourself, as Kristen Neff has said, treating yourself like someone you actually like. And the work is so difficult and so challenging that we're quick to criticize ourselves. But I think to lead, you have to take care of yourself. You have to treat yourself with self-compassion. And a big part of that is just being aware of your self-talk. Is the way I talk to myself inside my head in my darker moments, is it helping me be more successful or is it interfering with my capacity? That's a big part of leading yourself. Leading others, part of that is about reinforcing a particular kind of culture. You know, everybody in an organization creates the culture. It's not just the principal's job. We shouldn't externalize the creation of culture. Culture is about creating the place you want to work for you and for the kids in the school and for your colleagues. And then two other big things we talk about are being a multiplier versus a diminisher, interacting in ways that amplify other people's capacities, and then balancing ambition with humility. We did a big study on this, and we found that the most effective coaches balance those two things. And the thing is, one without the other doesn't get it done. If I'm really responsive to teachers and I listen, but I'm not that reliable. I'm not ambitious for change. People don't like to waste time. Not much is probably going to happen. If I'm really driven, but I don't listen to my teachers, I'm not responsive, I push, 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 people are likely to push back. But when I balance out humility with ambition for change, then I'm likely going to be more successful as a leader as I move forward. So those are just a few little tips about the whole leadership issue.
Yeah, no, that's been very helpful, Jim. So basically, we're sitting here at the moment. We've got the partnership principles, and Chris used the word fundamental and foundational, and that's the starting point. And we get that in place. And then, Chris, you moved on to the whole importance of communication skills and again, ideas of stance, being in service of the other person. Jim, you were very helpful, I suppose, getting us through that idea of coaches as leaders. So when we think about this conversation that we're having, and Chris, you said it's not just a conversation, tell us a little bit about this impact cycle.
So I'm very self-conscious talking about the impact cycle when the person who developed it is on the call as well. But I think I know what I'm talking about, Jim. So jump in. But I think if we think about the partnership principles are the way of being of the coach, and that's a phrase we've kind of adopted and from various sources and Christian von Neuberg and so on. It's that how I show up, how others experience me. And then I've got the communication skills. That gets us partway there. But when we're working on this improvement project with a teacher together, you know, and we'll see other bits of that as well, we are partnering with the teacher, we need some shape or some process to hang that on. So I often talk about the impact cycle providing that shape and structure to the series of conversations we're going to have over time. So again, it emphasizes that coaching is not an event, it's not a one-off conversation, it's a journey we're going on together, where I'm partnering with you to help you hit goals that you want to hit. And ideally, those goals that we are formulating together are what we would call peers' goals. They're very much student-centered goals. The measure of success is what I see change in the students, whether that's achievement or engagement or other things. And that's a slightly different thing from sometimes we hear people talk about teacher practice goals, and the emphasis is all on the practice. You'll do this, you'll share your learning intentions, you'll do whatever it is. And actually, what we're focusing on here in the first part of this process is what's the difference we want to see in the students, and naming the goal in those terms. So the first stage of that process, there's three stages to it, is the identify phase or stage. And really, that has to start with the teacher having a clear picture of their current reality in their classroom. So there may be video, there may be some data in there. And out of that, the teacher identifies something partnership with the coach supporting that conversation that they really want to work on, and formulates a goal around what they want to see different for the students in that particular class. So it's very local, it's very close to the action, it's very much student driven with their students and the teacher in the driving seat. So that phase of identifying the goal, seeing the current reality, identifying the goal, and then seeing a pathway to hit that goal. And that's where we start to make the bridge to, so what's the instructional strategy that might help us or has the best chance of giving us a pathway to hitting that goal? There's then the next stage, which is the learn stage or the learn phase of the conversation. And that's a dialogical stage very much, because it's then that the coach may need to share some information about the strategies. They might use checklists, they might use modeling, they might co-plan. They work in partnership with the teacher to help them understand and learn about that strategy so that they're ready to go and implement that and try that out in the classroom. Now, that's quite a linear sounding process to that point. What makes it a cycle is it rarely works first time. How many times have we tried something or tried to change something in their practice, and all those deeply ingrained habits and so on, all the complexity? The next phase of the process is improve. Now, when you look at this in a diagram, people say that's an improvement cycle. Yes, it is. But it implies that change happens iteratively. So the improve stage is then us coming together and saying, so what are we noticing? What data can we gather that shows us whether that's making the impact or not? And I would probably suggest, Jim, if you've hit that goal straight away in one hit, it probably wasn't a very powerful or emotionally compelling goal. It's most likely going to take adaptations, iterations, tweaks, changes. And again, the coach is there alongside partnering to help make those adaptations. And then we go again. And we go and we adapt and we try again, because it's not one lesson, one class. You think of your background in primary, Richard. There's all sorts of things going on all the different times of the day. I was a secondary teacher. I might not see that class again for another week. You know, so there's a process there. So in summary, the impact cycle process or structure is kind of the shape to these series of conversations that builds momentum, but helps make those iterative changes to practice until we see the change we want to see in the students and we hit the goal. And then it's, so what's next? You know, that might be the end of the cycle. Jim, is that a fair summation? Anything you want to?
I like it. As you know, Chris, I think no one knows both worlds, growth coaching and instruction coaching, better than you. So I think it sounds great. And the next one's data. So maybe I'll dive in and talk about data. I'll steal the question from Richard before he goes there. But
go for it.
Just to build on what you said, Chris, I really think you put the priority in the right place, you know, keeping kids first. And so here's sort of how I see this and how data fits into this, is the traditional forms of professional development, often what happens is some consultant or researcher shows up at the school, and they say, here's what research says about effective practice. Let me teach you how to do it. Now you go do it and things will be good for kids because research says it's an effective practice. So you just do it. And sometimes teachers sit in those workshops and they're like, well, that sounds like kind of a good idea. Or maybe they don't like it. They don't see the relevance. But they're there. Maybe I'll give it a try. But they give it a try. And then the easiest, it doesn't usually go that great the first time. It's their first time implementing. And the easiest thing to do is to drift back to what they used to do. And their voice wasn't heard as they thought about it. They were just told, we're going to focus on teacher clarity or cooperative learning or whatever it might be, differentiation. And then we would say, let's go the other way around. Let's start with kids. Let's say, what's the change we need to see in kids? Once we can identify the change we see in kids, then we help set a goal. Take the, as you said, Chris, the identify stage to identify a goal. Once we've got the goal, then we say, okay, well, what does research tell us about strategies? And then let's keep working at it using that impact cycle till we get there. So we believe when you start with kids and you involve teacher in the process of analyzing what's happening and set goals that matter, you're going to get a much greater level of commitment. You've got a built-in standard for excellence, which is, did the goal get hit? And you've got a higher degree of commitment on the part of the teacher because they're working on the goal that matters to them. To me, the way we've done it historically of starting with the research doesn't make as much sense as starting with kids and then working down to the research. Research is just as important. It's just used in the service of what's best for kids. So then when we look at the kids, how do we measure what happens? That's what the data is. And so we break the data down into two categories, engagement and achievement. And so in engagement, we're talking about how kids behave in the class, and you get to find the terms to some extent, their level of cognitive engagement. Are they getting out of the activity what they're supposed to get out of it? Emotional engagement. Do they feel safe in school, like they belong? And then for achievement, we have six different ways of measuring achievement, and depends, are we talking about acquisition or transfer? Are we talking about knowledge or skills or concepts? And we put it all together into this big approach. Now, I want to say one last thing. I've been saving up this joke, Richard. Now, you've probably heard this joke, but I thought I would use it today. The joke is like this. In fact, it's almost, I would say, 99% chance you've heard the joke. But this guy comes home. He's so drunk he can barely walk. He staggers down the street. He walks up to his front porch. He drops the keys. He can't find the keys. A little later, a policeman comes along, and he's standing under the light in front of his house looking for his keys. And the officer says, well, did you drop your keys here? And he says, no, I didn't drop my keys here, but the light is way better over here. And so I'm looking. And so I'm sure you've heard the joke, but here's the deal. If our assessments only look at achievement and they don't look at things related to emotional engagement, do kids feel like they belong? Do they love learning? Do they have positive experiences in school? Do they have well-being? If our assessments only look at achievement, it's a little bit like that drunk trying to find his keys where the key isn't. Maybe the more important things, or at least equally important to achievement, are, did the kids feel like they belong in school? Do they have friends? Do they have positive experiences? Do they feel efficacious about their life? And data helps us see things we wouldn't otherwise see. So that's the power of data.
I think that's been helpful because, Jim, I mean, data gets a really bad rap You know, in a lot of education systems right across the world, I know certainly here in Northern Ireland, that's the case. And I think, you know, your approach to instructional coaching helps broaden that out. You know, it's something that's full of possibility. You know, it's a rich thing, and it's something that teachers, and through a lot of your writing, you know, teachers are encouraged to look for data. You know, and I think once you get into that, you can start. I mean, your latest book, you know, Data Rules, you can start to see the potential for how important data actually is. In many ways, you know, affirming you as a teacher for what's going well. And what teacher doesn't want that, but also, you know, helping to look for the gaps. But that's been super helpful, and the joke's been really helpful too. We enjoyed that as well.
I want to draw on something on the joke, because actually that word, and it's a tenuous link, Jim, and I'm not just building up your joke here, but it's it was great on its own. But the idea of illuminating, that light thing, the illuminating, in a partnership approach, you are working with the teacher to choose what we want to shine a light on. What information can we gather? You know, sometimes the word information is less threatening or less loaded than data to some. But I think as long as we are clear what we mean by data, how can we illuminate what's happening now? How can we illuminate those things that, you know, how will you know when that's happening? What will be the signs that we would expect to see? Well, let's go looking for that. And then there's a discernment around, so what would be the most effective way for us, you and I together, to gather that data? Whereas in some more top-down models, it's that the coach is positioned as a diagnostician, and there's so much power and status in that. I think in a partnership approach, we are collaboratively deciding what we're going looking for, and we're looking at it together, and we're making sense of it together. So it starts to change those connotations of the word data away from measurement and more towards, let's get a clear picture of reality now. How has reality changed in my classroom, you know? And I think that's much, much more palatable. And it's an absolutely essential aspect of what you do as a coach. Otherwise, you just we're talking in these theoretical terms, you know.
It's going to be interesting. The folks, Jim, who will be attending the first Instructional Coaching Done Well Roadshow will be expecting either that joke or a very cool slide to go with Chris's analogy of illuminating and shining a light instead of the word data. But that's genuinely been very helpful. We've talked about principles, we've talked about data, we've talked about communication, and these are all very important things. And we're going to throw a really, really important word into the mix, Chris, and that's teaching. Okay, so ultimately, we're all teachers, and that's who we are at heart. And ultimately, teaching strategies will play a big part in as one of the 7 success factors for instructional coaching done well. Tell us a little bit more about how teaching strategies play out.
Yeah. And I think up to now we've talked about the who of being a coach and the how of being a coach, and there's communication and there's the process in there. In some ways in instructional coaching, the teaching strategies are the what. Or actually, I'm probably more accurate to what I said earlier, student learning is the what. You know, that's the student outcomes are the what. But the pathway to get there are the teaching strategies, the pathways. And this links to all sorts of theory around hope theory and so on, where people can feel they have agency, they know they can act on this thing, but they don't really know what to change first or what to work on, or they don't really have the depth of understanding of a particular strategy. They've just got their default things that they've always done. And so the pathways thinking comes when we start to partner with a coachee and help them see, if we do more of this and less of that, and here's a strategy that might help. Notice my provisional language, the word might is always in there. That will give us a pathway to that thing we want to see in the students. And actually, we're going to check on it. We're going to use data to see how we're going, to course correct, to adapt, to add another strategy, to build on that one. The coach in instructional coaching, the coach brings that expertise. They don't show up as the expert, but they bring expertise to the table to deploy in that very responsive way that we talked about right at the start, based on what they're seeing the need is for that person. And so in factor 6, we talk about, so how do we collate, how do we bring together that body of instructional expertise and knowledge that the coach brings? And we advocate for an instructional playbook as the way to do that. So it's a simple, straightforward way of bringing together these, what we've agreed as a school often or a district, are the well-founded instructional practices that we want to hang our hat on. And that's not, Jim, when I'm delivering this in a workshop, I often have your high impact instruction book, and we know there are lots of others we could choose, but that's not a playbook. That's the first thing I hold up and I say, look, this is a textbook that's got all the detail of all the things that the coach might need to know, and you can draw on it. But a playbook is that stripped down essential ingredients of these key practices. And for me, the playbook is a dialogical tool. It's not a teaching and learning manual. It's a tool that contains these distilled communication tools that generate dialogue and sense-making conversations between the coach and the coachee. And they can be used in different ways. The checklists can be used as a lens on the practice when they might be watching me model it. They can say, oh, I noticed when Jim did that bit. Oh, and I can see where his next move is and so on. So you're making sense of that. But there's a sophistication and a balance in, and Jim, you might want to say a bit more about this. There's a bit of an art in distilling into what is an effective instructional playbook that then becomes a good dialogical tool for the coach and the coachee. It's a communication tool versus ending up developing a manual of here's everything we do. And you arrive at my school, Richard, and I say, here's the manual of how we teach here, which sounds much more top down and maybe bordering teaching for dummies for me. So there's something in between there, I think, that's a bit more sophisticated. But there's the way, fundamentally, it's the what. It's what are the strategies that we know are, I like to say, well-founded, research-informed, evidence-based, that look like they would have a high degree of success in your situation to get that thing you want to see in the students. And we set off on that pathway and adapt as we go. Jim, is there anything you would add to that?
Oh, I think that's great. I think that the essence of the playbook is, to create it, you have to have a depth of knowledge. And what you're creating are communication tools that make it really easy for you to translate research into practice. I could say, I want to learn about feedback. Well, then there's all kinds of books about feedback. I'm looking through, well, this isn't really what I need. But if a coach can show up and say, well, I read all the literature on feedback, it sounds like you might want to look at it this way, share a checklist, a description of it. And then that description is describing a strategy that's going to help, as you said, it's a pathway to hitting a goal. And so it's going to evolve. It's going to be changed. It's going to be modified. It's not carved in stone. It's something the two of them work out together and they keep refining it until the goal gets hit. And then the last part, I think, is that the document create, the playbook, is a living document. And as coaches and teachers learn more about what works, they refine the playbook. It becomes a richer and richer, simple, not simplistic, but simple document that you have to understand it to create it. And then once you've got it, you've got tools to make it easier to translate research into practice. That's kind of how we would see it.
I'm intrigued by the playbook, Jim and Chris, and thank you for clarifying a lot of that. And I think about my own scenario, you know, introducing instructional coaching over here essentially into a blank canvas where it hasn't been done before in any shape or form. And the instructional playbook plays a very, very important part in that process. I would imagine, now correct me if I'm wrong, the ideal way is you co-create that instructional playbook as you go along. Because at the moment, I could very, very easily source any number of, I suppose, instructional playbooks, in inverted commas, to provide a school with. What are your thoughts, Jim, on that? Co-creation, not versus buying something off the shelf, but you know the pros and cons in there. I would love to hear a bit more about that.
Well, the purpose of the playbook is to help teachers hit their goals. So when we design a playbook, given world enough and time, the first question is, what are most likely going to be the kind of goals teachers are going to have to hit? Now, you might look at the science of learning and read something like Brian Goodwin's book, The New Classroom Instruction That Works, and look at it that way, moving from are the kids interested down to extend and apply and look at the six phases of learning. And you might organize it that way. But the first thing is, what are the goals? And then what are our best bets on how to set the goals? If I'm sitting down with a teacher and we set a goal, and then the teacher says, now, what's our strategy? And it's possible the teacher will know the strategy they want to use, but they also might come to me because they're not sure what to do. They might say, well, if I knew what to do, I'd be doing it. I don't know what to do. And if I say to the teacher, well, I got nothing, it's not really helpful. So I have the playbook helps me, as Chris's term, helps me give a pathway to the goal. And then, as I said, it's co-constructed in the sense that you're continually refining it. You might learn something from students. You might learn something from a teacher. A coach might learn something in the act of sharing it. And learning is going to happen when you start to use. You might say this strategy isn't the right one for our school. We need a different approach, you know, and so forth. But it's continually becoming, and then it becomes just a part of the fabric. And then when people want to learn something, they come to the coach and the coach says, well, let's see what we can do. And they get the process of the impact cycle going.
We get the great privilege of working with so many schools and organizations that are grappling with this. And Jim, we've both got stories from different people we've worked with where they've made the mistake, first of all, of saying, all right, we're the experts, we'll develop this playbook. And then we present it to the teachers and say, here's how we teach around here. And well, how does that sit with the partnership principles? And actually some of the feedback, that school I'm thinking of in particular, that some of the feedback they got was, well, what did you say about equality and voice and choice and so on, you know, a couple of weeks ago? So then it became a more of a dialogue, but we're not naive enough to think, well, if you're a staff, you imagine your staff, Richard, you know, to embark on developing a playbook collaboratively is a big undertaking. But I would suggest it's a really powerful professional learning exercise in yourself. And we know schools that have taken it that way as well. Let's literally co-construct and invest the time in professional learning sessions. And then you get others who come to this who've already been doing a lot of thinking about instructional models, about the science of learning, about this framework, that framework. They've been doing different contexts, international schools, but you know, different situations. So I think what we realize is that if you haven't been looking at teaching and learning, pedagogy, instructional practice, whatever you call it in your jurisdiction, instructional coaching starts to shine a light on that gap, because you need the what. You need something to hang this on. You need some practices. And there's an ever-increasing body of knowledge out there, ever-increasing, around what Dylan William calls the more profitable routes might be in instruction. So I think that everybody will come to this at a different point, but I think if you're doing instructional coaching without having the expertise or having some way of sharing that effectively with the teacher, it quickly becomes apparent. And I think, Jim, you know, years and years ago when instructional coaching started, the playbook wasn't a thing, but it kind of emerged and evolved as being an important part of it. We could do a whole podcast on just playbooks, probably. I think that's what I'm suggesting.
Well, you know what happened, Chris, is I was on a plane and I was flying across the U.S. and I sat beside this person who worked for a software giant, and she was a trainer. She would go work in places and she would teach people how to use these different types of software. And I said, well, how do you know they're going to use it when you leave? I'm really interested in this because we do kind of the same thing. We help people learn things. And she said, well, we create playbooks. And then when I heard that word, I'm like, oh, that's what we need to do. That's the day that instructional playbooks were born. So that's where it all started, was somewhere on a plane in the United States.
Fantastic. A little bit of history in there, which is also useful as well. And again, it's reflective of the fact that it's an ongoing, evolving process, instructional coaching, which I think is helpful as well. The seventh of the success factors, Jim, to come back to you, is this idea of system support. And again, you know, I'm thinking through this as a former school principal, who, you know, essentially, you've got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies in school, and you've an important role to play in all aspects of running a school. But when it comes to instructional coaching done well in a school, where does system support come in?
Well, you know, I think without system support, it's going to be really challenging to work. So I want to say a little bit about what that means. And the first thing I'd say is the seven success factors, they're not nice to haves. They're must-haves if you want change to happen. I'm not saying you have to do it my way. I just don't know how you could do it. What are the assumptions that drive your work? It's pretty hard to have a coach who can't ask good questions, who isn't a very good listener. And then a disorganized coach who hasn't got their time organized, or who interacts in ways to diminish other people, probably not going to be very successful. So that whole first part we call who I am, my beliefs, my way of communicating, my way of leading. The second part, what I do, as Chris said, is the impact cycle. It's that and you probably need some kind of universal cycle for change. That's what we refer to as the impact cycle. And then if you're going to use the cycle, you're going to have to set up goals and to see what's happening in the classroom. You need to be able to notice the level of emotional engagement, or whether or not the kids can organize their writing using a rubric, or whatever the tools are to look at what's happening. You without data literacy, you're going to miss, I don't know if you can have literacy about data, but anyway, understanding it, you're going to miss things. You know, once you have the data, you can see things you wouldn't otherwise see. And you need the strategies to take you there. Once you set the goal, it's not much good if you can't get there. So you need a playbook to help you hit there. So the what I do part is we need a cycle for change to make the cycle work. We need strategies to take us to the goal, and we need data to help us see where we're trying to get to. Now, the system support is you can have all six of those things, but without system support, you might not have much impact. So that means there needs to be widespread understanding across the system about what it is that coaching, because coaching, here is this person who's going to appreciate me, see my strengths, validate me, and help me focus on the thing I most want to do, make it easier for me to hit the goals I'm most concerned with. People should be lining up for that. That shouldn't be something anybody's hesitating to do, but they don't if there isn't widespread understanding of what coaching is. And so leaders in particular in school systems have to understand what are these practices and what do coaches do and how does the whole thing work. And then the other part is the evaluation of the coach. You know, too often coaches are evaluated by someone who doesn't understand coaching using a tool that was created for teachers. You really need to have an evaluation tool designed for coaches. And then clarity around things like, what's our policy on confidentiality and time to create the playbook and time for professional learning? The leaders, of course, need to lead the charge when it comes to change. And so in partnership, in collaboration with the coach, really great things can happen. But if the leaders aren't leading, they don't have the understanding they need, they aren't supporting the coach and making sure the coach actually has time and there isn't role clarity, all those things are going to make it really difficult. So we'd sort of lay out about six or seven key things like role clarity, like how the coach uses their time, like widespread understanding and support of the coach and what that looks like, policies that support coaches that we would say all have to be in place, along with the fact that evaluation is actually evaluating coaching. And it's not just a little box to be checked off. It's really helping the coach and the program move forward. That's the way we would put it. So the seven to us are like a rubric. And as you develop your program, you can ask yourself, where am I on this rubric? What do we need to, maybe we need to work on the playbook. Maybe we need to develop our skills with data. Maybe we need to really get better at the questioning aspects of coaching or the impact cycle or whatever. The seven success factors function like a rubric, and the leaders are the ones who put that rubric into practice.
Yeah, and I think that's really, really helpful, particularly for listeners who are in a leadership position. You know, there'll be leaders listening to this and coming along, hopefully, to the roadshow, and they need to have, you know, a good, solid understanding of where system support plays out. And I think that's one thing, gentlemen, that you've done for me and for our listeners today is very much you've brought all of these factors together. Because if you go online or you buy the books and you'll see these seven success factors, you know, listed, you know, on a page or on a website or on a screen, and you see them as seven sort of separate items. What you've done today, which has been very helpful, is bring them all together. And I love that phrase, these are not nice to haves, these are must haves. So we go back to that word fundamental. I think we can't move away from that word, which is why we're starting this particular episode looking at the seven success factors. Gentlemen, that brings us to the end of this first episode in our Instructional Coaching Done Well mini-series. A huge thank you to you both for sharing your insights and vast experience. As we've heard today, instructional coaching done well is first and foremost built on the seven success factors. For our listeners, if you're keen to dive even deeper into the success factors, there are invaluable video clips, articles, further podcast episodes available on both the Instructional Coaching Group website and the GCI website. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please do be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the rest of this little mini-series. And if you're in Australia, don't forget to check out the Instructional Coaching Done Well Roadshow happening in three separate locations across June 2025. All the details can be found at growthcoaching.com.au.